The American Legion wants to know. The American Legion wants to know the role of air power in modern war. In this series of broadcasts, the American Legion has asked, how good is American air power? To discuss the role of air power in modern war on this program, the guests of the American Legion are Lieutenant General Thomas D. White, United States Air Force, and Rear Admiral Thomas Combs, United States Navy. Here to moderate this discussion is Bruce P. Henderson, Chairman of the National Security Commission of the American Legion. Mr. Henderson.
The American people have been told for some time, and most of us now believe, that air power is the prime component of our defense forces. But what does that mean in terms of the job that air power is supposed to do? What is the mission? Why is it so important? How is it being carried out or approached? Here to answer these and similar questions are two men well qualified by professional experience. They are Lieutenant General Thomas D. White, Deputy Chief of Staff, Operations of the United States Air Force, and Rear Admiral Thomas S. Combs, Chief of the Bureau of Aeronautics, United States Navy. Now, General Eisenhower, among others, has referred to the dominant role of air power in modern war. Can you describe for us, gentlemen, just what that role is? General White?
Well, air power has become the dominant force in modern war because of three roles or characteristics. First, air forces have the capability to strike directly and powerfully at those root sources of national strength which are essential to support a war effort. Second, control of the air is vital to the successful employment of all surface forces. Third, the characteristics of flexibility and firepower of air forces permits rapid shifting of air effort from one fighting front to another and enables attack on a wide variety of targets, extending all the way from the front line back to a national capital thousands of miles removed.
Admiral Combs, would you care to comment on that?
Yes, Mr. Henderson. The growth of naval aviation has given new range and punch to the fleet. And we no longer think of sea power alone. We think of the powerful combination, which we call sea-air power.
Now, with that background behind us, let's consider the Navy side alone for a moment. Admiral Combs, where does the aircraft carrier fit into this picture? What is the need for and the role of the carrier?
The Navy's main mission is to control the seas. And to do that, we have to control the air over the seas. If war comes, we either have to fight it at home or cross an ocean to meet the enemy. If we do not have control of the sea, we have to fight at home. We also have to keep the sea lanes open to ensure a steady flow of strategic materials which this country needs to keep up its industrial might. There are three major threats to our control of the seas: enemy mines, submarines, and air attack on shipping. The best spot to defeat these threats is at their source. The sub pens, the mine depots, and airfields are prime targets, and the best way to erase them is from the air. Swift jet fighters and attack planes flying off carriers can do any of these jobs and more. The aircraft carrier is the Navy's answer to having a landing strip where you want it, when you want it. It's a potent weapon that can launch an attack from any direction where there is navigable water.
In that connection, Admiral, I think there's a great deal of disagreement, or at least misunderstanding in the public mind, on this next point. Just how vulnerable is the modern fast aircraft carrier as we know it today?
I'm very glad you asked that question, Mr. Henderson. There seems to be a popular myth that carriers are highly vulnerable. The Japanese know differently. They lost 15,000 planes trying to prove it. Only four of our 33 fast carriers, which we used in the Pacific, were sunk during World War II, and not one of those to land-based aircraft. I was commanding officer of the USS Yorktown, better known as the Fighting Lady, and we saw plenty of these planes. What people don't realize is that we not only have our own fighters to protect us, but that the average fast carrier task group has a concentration of over 1,600 guns for use in its anti-aircraft defense.
Well, what about submarines?
Anything that floats has to worry about submarines, Mr. Henderson. But to say we should not have carriers because they can be sunk is the same as saying because thousands of soldiers can be killed, we should not have an army. or because bombers can be shot down, we should not have any bombers. Wars are not fought that way. Sinking a carrier is not easy and cannot be done by one torpedo, as many imagine. Carriers are heavily compartmented and have proved in the past that one can absorb several torpedoes and still live to fight another day.
Well, how about an atomic attack?
There's not much doubt in my mind that an atomic bomb hit on a carrier could sink it. But remember, a moving target is hard to hit, and ships are not very profitable atomic targets. Vessels of a carrier task force are normally spaced about a mile apart. A direct hit from an atomic bomb might sink or disable the vessel hit, but it would cause little or no damage to the others. We found this out at Bikini, and every miss means one less A-bomb that could be used on an American city.
General White, I think I better turn to you now for a while.
Well, I'd like to comment a minute on the carrier business.
Fine.
I would like to add that the Air Force has supported the Navy and will continue to support the Navy in a carrier program, which is essential to control of the sea lines of communications. We believe that the Navy should fully exploit air power in the performance of naval missions. By the same token, we believe that certain tasks such as strategic bombing and air defense and air support of ground forces are more economically and effectively performed by land-based aviation.
General White, what in your judgment are the primary lessons we've learned in the Korean Air War?
Well, sir, the Korean War, as you know, from an air point of view, has been a limited war. We have had to attack thousands of dispersed targets rather than a limited number of more concentrated targets. We have had to fight enemy air power almost exclusively in the air, rather than destroying it at base. In adjusting these special conditions, we have confirmed our belief that the flexibility and firepower of our air forces are their greatest assets. In addition, we have learned that Soviet aircraft are of high quality, and that the Soviets are capable of building a powerful modern air force. We all have also had a chance to service test our own jet aircraft, both in support of the ground forces and in the daily F-86 Sabre jet MiG-15 battles. Consistent with our earlier conviction that superiority in speed, altitude, and range are essential, we have found the jets less vulnerable to enemy action than propeller-driven aircraft in any type of operation, and also more effective, including support of ground forces.
Admiral Combs, how about the Navy Air?
Mr. Henderson, we have reaffirmed that the effort and time that we have put in on our naval reserve has again paid off. We've also proved that our program of mothballing ships and airplanes was sound. We were given very little money to buy new planes between World War II and Korea, and if we had not been able to take some old ones out of mothballs, we would have been in bad shape today. Of course, we understand we could be doing a better job if we'd had new planes. All in all, probably one of the most important lessons we learned in Korea was how to operate and to maintain our jet fighters for relatively long periods of time with only shipboard or meager shoreside facilities to patch their battle wounds.
General White, can you describe briefly our strategic bombing attack and air defense concepts?
Well, of course, the concept of strategic bombing is nothing new. In biblical times, it was common practice for warring clans to tie firebrands to the tails of foxes and release the animals in the ripened grain fields of the enemy, the objective, of course, being to destroy the sustaining resources of the foe. Our concept today is changed only to accommodate to more powerful weapons and to the complexities of the structure which supports a modern war effort. Short of war, we view the Strategic Air Command as the greatest deterrent to Soviet aggression. In case we are attacked, the Strategic Air Command would retaliate and attempt to destroy the industrial base of the Soviet Union so that it would be compelled to fight with only those forces and supplies in being at the start of the war. No modern force can fight long if denied gasoline, oil, supplies, and equipment. With respect to air defense, we believe that the best defense is a good offense. We must have a good, strong air defense command to minimize as much as possible the effects of an air attack on the United States.
Admiral Combs, do you have anything to add to that?
I have only one comment to make. I noted particularly that General White mentioned the supplies of gasoline and oil and materials that they would need. That's our job. By command of the seas, we will supply those for the Air Force and for the Army as they need them.
General White, how has the advent of the atomic bomb modified our concept of air power employment?
Well, Mr. Henderson, we feel that the advent of the atomic bomb has not changed the basic missions of air power. It has, however, meant that much greater damage to national structures can be done quickly, and it has put a premium on quality and reliability and emphasizes the necessity for an adequate Air Force in a constant state of readiness. The chief significance of the atomic bomb lies in our own national vulnerability. It would have been logistically impossible for the Soviets to bomb the United States out of a war with ordinary high explosives. The atomic bomb now makes this possible.
Admiral Combs?
Mr. Henderson, I only would like to add that the Navy has participated in the development and refinement of the atomic bomb, and carrier-based aircraft can deliver this bomb, if directed to do so, at ranges comparable to the distances it can carry the more conventional bombs.
The point has been made here that air power, which basically is developed around an airplane, is the first element of our military forces to become engaged, to see action. And furthermore, that building air power requires the longest time. In view of this, are appropriate steps being taken to assure adequate aircraft production and an industry capable of providing quality aircraft in sufficient quantity? Admiral Combs?
Mr. Henderson, we have the industry, the aircraft industry, all right, and most of our production woes are behind us. We still have our problems. But Congress has just now lopped off a good-sized chunk of the procurement funds for the coming fiscal year. In my opinion, that is false economy, and if the cut is not restored, our fighting potential will be greatly weakened.
General White, what do you say about this?
Well, I quite agree. I'd like to add the fact that the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Secretary of Defense have recommended a program for air power, which was to be completed by July 1954. Congressional action, as the Admiral has stated, is still taking place on the 1953 budget, and it is still too early to predict what the outcome of congressional actions will be. We are behind in the development of essential air strength. The Joint Chiefs of Staff recognize this when they recommended a 50% increase in the strength of the Air Force for 1953 and relatively lesser increases for the Army and Navy. We feel that every effort should be made to meet the Air Force goal on schedule.
Well, General, that's another point that we'd like to develop further, but I'm afraid our time is up. I want to take this opportunity to thank both of you gentlemen on behalf of the American Legion and the radio audience for this timely discussion of air power, mission number one. Now, this is Bruce Henderson closing out this fourth in a special series of American Legion broadcasts designed to better inform the American people on the status of our preparedness in the air.